ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. What does the American public think about recent high-profile Supreme Court decisions? ABC's Chuck Severson looks at a recent poll that found 52% approve of the court restricting the use of race in college admissions.
The sample in the new ABC News Ipsos poll is fairly split over the highest court striking down President Biden's student loan debt relief program. It was also pretty evenly split over the court's ruling favoring the evangelical Christian website designer who refused LGBTQ business. 53% say they believe the justices decide cases mainly on the basis of their partisan political views.
Two people were killed, 28 were hurt, three of them in critical condition in a mass shooting at a block party in Baltimore overnight. Police are now searching for suspects. Air travelers have been dealing with delays and cancellations this week, and they could face more today. 50 million people are under severe storm alerts. 60 million are under heat advisories as a heat dome covers 14 states. This is ABC News. CIA Director Bill Burns, speaking in England on Saturday, said Russia's war in Ukraine has led to the CIA ramping up its recruiting efforts within Russia. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president's accusing Russia of preparing to trigger an explosion at Zaporizhia, the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. ABC's Patrick Reeval has more from Ukraine.
Fresh concerns Russia could try to freeze their southern front line by creating a nuclear catastrophe at the Zaporizhia power plant. Ukraine's President Zelensky warning there is a serious threat. Russia is ready to provoke an explosion at the plant. Ukraine's military intelligence chief claiming Russia has finished placing explosives at the plant. Ukraine this week holding emergency drills.
And officials in Atlanta say police department motorcycles were damaged by an intentional fire set early Saturday inside of a training center. WANF-TV said the cause of the fire is under investigation. Brian Clark, ABC News.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Tom from Madtown. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. Heard you talking about Robin Voss, so I called Robin Voss's office and said, yeah, why is DEI so dangerous? And nothing. The guy just stopped talking. I said, hello, are you there? I called him back, and the phone got picked up, and then they didn't say anything. You know, maybe you'll learn something if you listen to The Devil's Advocate.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Small towns in Wisconsin stand to benefit from a billion-dollar federal investment in high-speed internet announced this week. Mike Moan reports.
The funding comes from the multi-year federal infrastructure law that was adopted in late 2021. Federal officials say more than 8 million households and small businesses in the U.S. are in areas where there's no high-speed internet infrastructure. In Wisconsin's Jefferson County, Deb Reinbold leads Thrive Economic Development and says it's welcome news for smaller towns.
It's a huge opportunity for the state. In today's interconnected world, broadband's not just a luxury, it's a lifeline, and especially for rural communities.
Reinbold says her area has seen progress thanks to separate grants in recent months, but she adds there are still some areas that need service, and there's hope the new funding will close remaining gaps. According to a statewide task force report, nearly 7% of Wisconsinites lack access to the SEC standard for download speed, and most of those residents are in rural areas. Reinbold, also a board member with the Wisconsin Rural Partners Group, says beyond helping rural residents and small businesses, the extra funding allows health providers in these communities to easily connect with patients.
Telehealth is also something that, you know, we're seeing such a significant investment in from our area medical clinics and hospitals. Honestly, the impact is very widespread.
Wisconsin's Public Service Commission will be in charge of distributing the grants. In a statement, it says it will ensure the funding goes to where it's needed as quickly as it can, while maintaining transparency and being stewards of taxpayer dollars. Mike Moan, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel, and yes, it is Saturday, July 1st, the first day of the new month. A very special broadcast this morning on Morning Cannolis. As always, it's our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news events, those occurrences and stories in law, government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America, especially relevant this morning as we spend all of our 2 hours together talking about, once again, the United States Supreme Court. We're coming to you this morning, as always, from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha here in beautiful Wisconsin. But we're broadcasting throughout the listening regions of civic media in our state. Those include WMDX in Madison, WAUK right here in Waukesha, WRJN in Racine, WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids, WXCO in Wausau, WBZH in Haywood, WLAK in Amory, WISS in Oshkosh, WGBW in Green Bay, WRCE in Richland Center, WLCS in La Crosse, and yes, from a venue at which I recently did appear in one of the broadcasts of Civic Media, W228EP, The Tap in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, welcoming guests, listeners, and participants in our discussion from throughout the state of Wisconsin. Thank you for joining me this morning on Morning Cannolis. As always, especially this morning, we're going to be taking your calls at 844-967-2789. That number again, 844-967-2789. Taking those calls, inviting those calls through my professional, my engaging, my always effective producer, Anya, who's with me in the studios this morning. Looking forward to hearing from you. Your questions, especially this morning, your inquiries, your comments, your observations about the topics of these days. And yes, the topic of these days is the United States Supreme Court, especially focused this morning on four major decisions issued by our high court just in the past 48 hours or so. Even so, our discussion this morning always organized around three basic questions. What happened? What are the facts? What do we know about these cases in particular? Why? Why are these decisions important to America, not only presently, but in the future generations yet to come? Why are they relevant? What's material about them? And then the all-important question that we sometimes leave unanswered in America, what do we do about this? What do we do going forward to address concerns and issues that we have about decisions of the Supreme Court, those that are affirming of the humanity that is our nation, and those that tend to send us back? A lot of discussion this morning about the second of those categories, not excluding the first. Last week, we began the first of this three-arc series of broadcasts in which we're going to be focusing upon the United States Supreme Court. As you know, listeners of this program know well, that this is the period of time every single year when our United States Supreme Court, nine members of our highest court in the land, issue their so-called high-ticket items, the big decisions of the past term. This is the 22-23 term. Last week, we talked about four of those major cases, very different in temperament, in tone, in content than what we're going to be talking about this morning. We talked last week about this major case affirming the legislatively supported authority, the discretion, the ability of the Secretary of Homeland Security to operate his agency as he chooses, exercising discretion on behalf of the people of America to ensure that our immigration laws are applied fairly and evenly, focusing on deportations just as to those people who pose the greatest threat to our national security, our safety, our security generally in our communities. A challenge to that pushed back by the United States Supreme Court that said in a major decision that, yes, indeed, the Secretary of Homeland Security does have the authority given to him by the Congress to ensure that our immigration laws are supported equitably and decently, but setting priorities given a circumstance of limited resources, focusing on those people who pose the greatest threats to our safety and security, an affirmation of executive branch authority, something we did not see this past week, as we will get to in just a moment or so. A second case last week we talked about of confirming the long-settled meaning and import of the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act taking a fair number of hits recently by the Supreme Court, clipping its wings in terms of enforcement through the U.S. Department of Justice and even in other mechanisms. Recently, in this term, an affirmation of the Voting Rights Act in a major case that affirmed the right of Americans to vote regardless of color, affirming the capacity of our government to ensure that gerrymandered districts do not disenfranchise people of color, a major case that, again, reestablishes, as if we need to have that reestablished, apparently we do, that the Voting Rights Act means what it says and says what it means from 1965 to this day, a major case that, again, kept in place one of the major enforcement mechanisms of that all-important law. A third case last week upholding the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, sometimes called ICWA, the law that requires that state court judges, when they are addressing issues related to adoption, placement, custody, those kinds of things involving our youngest citizens, youth, that if you have before you as a judge, you are obliged under the law to give consideration to the Native American heritage of that young person. And when making decisions about placement, about custody and those kinds of things, attempting as best you possibly can to place that child in an environment, in a family that would support that heritage, this law as a part of ensuring that our heritage of indigenous populations in our nation is preserved for the future and also for the present. An affirmation upholding that law by our United States Supreme Court, the third of the cases we talked about last week. And the fourth one, validating the right of nursing home patients to sue if, in fact, they have been the victims of maltreatment, mistreatment by their health care providers. A major case coming out of the Seventh Circuit and Indiana in particular that, again, affirmed the right under Medicaid to ensure that families of people and individuals themselves who are the victims of mistreatment, health care mistreatment, have a right to sue. Sounds like a very narrow kind of decision, but actually very important to establishing once again that Medicaid remains strong. Also, Medicare derivatively coming out of that lawsuit. All those cases affirming and ensuring that Americans have access to all the good things established by and promoted by our Constitution and indeed by the Declaration of Independence that we celebrate in this coming weekend. This week, we're going to talk about four other cases that go in many ways in a different direction, that send us backwards in a way that is concerning, troubling, highly disconcerting for all of us who look forward to an America that is inclusive and contemplates equality and equity for all people. We're going to get to that in just a moment. We are celebrating in this coming weekend, the 4th of July, the 247th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, signed on this day, and establishing, again, all those fundamental rights that are implicit, if not explicit, in the cases we talked about last week, and implicitly recognized, if not completely advanced, by the United States Supreme Court in at least three of the four cases we're going to talk about this week. It is also the 234th anniversary in September of our U.S. Constitution, recognized on Constitution Day. Again, 234 years of that. In past broadcasts, I have routinely talked about things that have happened on this day in history, returning to that tradition today for recognition observance, a solemn observance of something that happened a year ago when we celebrated the 4th of July here in America, July 4th, 2022. You recall well, a young man used an assault weapon and a high-capacity magazine to fire about 70 rounds into around a group of parade goers in Highland Park, Illinois. He killed 11 people. He injured many, many others, including a very young man named Cooper Roberts, who was paralyzed from the waist down. Stories this weekend, a year later, about his resilience, even in the wake of this horrific tragedy, visited upon him, his family, and all of us in America, reminding us again that even on a day when we should be celebrating our liberty and our joy in this nation, it is often regrettably also marred, is pockmarked by this kind of horrific violence that we saw a year ago in Highland Park. What do we do about that kind of thing? What do we do? How do we respond to that kind of activity? Well, again, as we have talked about on this program, lots of things that can be done by our state legislature here in Wisconsin, by our federal legislature in Washington, D.C. We've talked about those remedies. They're available to us. We know they work because of experience with them. And we know as well that they should, in fact, be passed to ensure that the things that happened in Highland Park a year ago do not happen again. We think again about the other things that can be done. We know that coming out of Highland Park, two significant sets of things. We're going to talk today a lot about litigation, about cases, about court work that results in decisions that do in fact impact us positively and sometimes also negatively. Two big packages of litigation coming out of the Highland Park horror that terror visited upon us and that community in particular a year ago. We know that the young man, the 21-year-old, the shooter, has in fact been charged with 117 different charges, including 21 counts of first-degree murder. We expect that. We anticipate that when you engage in that kind of violent behavior in America, using firearms to disrupt not only a celebration of our nation, but also the peace and security that we should expect every day, every time we go out into public. We also know, however, coming out of that piece of horror in Highland Park, a couple of other things happened. The government is also suing, has also brought charges against the father in Lake County. Seven counts of reckless endangerment, reckless behavior, for his behavior in signing off on an application for this firearm that his son acquired under the Illinois Firearm ID Law that was required before one can buy a firearm. Charging him with this reckless conduct in doing that kind of thing, sending the message that you too, even if you're not the shooter, are responsible in part for this kind of behavior. And we also know that there is a lawsuit against Smith & Wesson, the maker of the assault weapon that was used in that violent conduct, alleging that they themselves, the makers of this gun, were involved in this horrific assault by virtue of establishing and promoting a campaign for this M&P-15, this assault rifle that was used at the time, specifically targeting youth, that promoted this kind of thing among youth who would be attracted to this weapon. All that kind of thing, that litigation, another thing that can be done and is being pursued today to address this horrific problem in America. And when we come back, some final thoughts about 4th of July in the wake of the Supreme Court decisions coming up this coming hour and next hour, a review of our Supreme Court. Stay with us for that discussion.
law firm of Gingras Thompson & Wachs has a track record of making life-changing positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs, 855-954-1186. The Todd Alba Show.
The most elitist scorn towards average people exists within sort of that conservative far-right ecosystem.
We're a couple of dudes who used to be Republicans. We were Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, Tommy Thompson, Scott Klug Republicans. This Republican Party you got now with Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux, the Republican Party at the top, want to start banning books, for God's sake.
Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
When you take the iconic Wienermobile and you call it the Frankmobile, come on, that is terrible.
The Kraft Heinz Company announced the name change to celebrate the brand's 100% beef franks as the company debuts a new recipe. Well, no more lips and other things, I guess.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope I don't get to the Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Kroot. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
And we are back here on Morning Cannolis, a discussion this morning of our United States Supreme Court and decisions it has made historically and very recently that affect who we are as a nation, how we live together, and the challenges that we face. Many of those challenges, much on the agenda of our discussion here this morning, our broadcast coming to you from Waukesha, always, always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Right before the break, talking about the fact that we're also observing in the days just ahead the 247th anniversary of our nation, recognizing, too, that our Constitution turns 234 years old in just a few short weeks as well. And it's out of that Constitution that much of our discussion this morning evolves and devolves in some ways, language of our Constitution and its interpretation. As we think about what happened in Highland Park a year ago, this mass shooting involving deaths of fellow citizens, fellow Americans, injuries to many, many more, and the consequences of that, the things we can do to address gun violence in America, which we know, including those pieces of criminal and civil litigation that I talked about right before the break. Also recognizing that there is a Supreme Court connection, of course, to firearms as well. Many, many years ago, establishing for the first time in our nation's history that under the Second Amendment, a decision issued by Antonin Scalia, that the Second Amendment does provide for all Americans the right to protection in the home by the use of a firearm, a decision never before issued by any Supreme Court, finding that the language of the Second Amendment that talks about a well-regulated militia actually establishes a personal right to ownership, an individual right to ownership in the home to protect you from intrusions or to ensure your self-defense. That position expanded by the Supreme Court just a short year ago, weeks before, days before the shooting in Highland Park in a case called Bruin, expanding that so-called constitutional right under the Second Amendment to include your capacity, your authorization to carry firearms in the public domain. outside of the home, expanding what Antonin Scalia had said, a decision issued by Clarence Thomas on behalf of the majority in June of last year, further expanding firearms rights in our nation at a time when this great, profound health care problem, this medical problem, this social problem, this cultural problem continues to beset us without any clear end in sight. Bruin is the name of that case that happened, that was decided just a year or so ago, establishing, expanding under the Second Amendment, the rights of Americans to carry firearms in public. And so appropriate this morning to talk again about the impact of the things that the United States Supreme Court does on the day-to-day operation of our lives, the ways in which we engage in each other. Let us start down that road now and talk about four major cases that have been issued just in the past 48 to 50 hours or so. Three of those highly, highly controversial and drawing the ire not only on the bench, on the Supreme Court bench, between majority and minority voices there. We'll talk a lot about that. Be doing a lot of readings this morning from what the Supreme Court justices said from their texts, said from their mouths during this past week or so. Beginning with a case in which the Supreme Court sided with a postal carrier who refused to work on the Sabbath. This case, unlike the others, unlike the three other cases we're going to be spending most of our time talking about this morning, this initial case, 9-0, a unanimous decision by our United States Supreme Court, including support not only by the so-called conservatives, the so-called liberals, some appellations which I bristle sometimes at because not always accurate in terms of describing how our Supreme Court justices approach decisions. But in this case, 9-0, all of them agreeing. On Thursday, our Supreme Court broadened protections undeniably for religious workers in this case that involved a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service who refused to work on the Sabbath. In this unanimous decision, 9-0, all the justices rejected a certain test that had been in place for many, many years up until this past week that had long been used to determine what accommodations an employer had to make for religious workers and what kinds of things an employer was obliged to do to address the specific requests of people of faith in the employment setting. Significantly, this case, this decision issued just a couple of days ago, was not a ruling on the merits of the case itself. They did not say that this worker is entitled to those accommodations. They sent it back to the trial court, back to the lower court for decision on that, for a trial on the merits under a new standard. And that's the reason why all nine members of the Supreme Court agreed to this. A new standard that established the circumstances, the legal predicate, if you will, for the circumstances under which an employer, public employer, private employer, is obliged to accommodate the specific religious requests of an employer. So writing for the court, Justice Scalia said that the case gave it the first opportunity, he said, in nearly 50 years, and that's right, to explain the nuances of how workplaces have to adapt to religious requests by the employees who are out there. For an employer to deny an employee's request for religious accommodation, Justice Alito wrote, again, on behalf of nine agreeing justices, and here we go, here's the new standard, that employer must show that the burden of granting an accommodation would result in, this is the big language coming out of this case, would result in a substantially increased cost assessment, substantial increased costs in relation to the conduct of the business. In other words, if in fact that accommodation is extended and granted to the employee, that has to be done unless it can be shown that there's a substantial, a significant, a great increase, a dramatic impact upon the very operation of the business itself. That decision obviously could affect countless workplaces out there, could require many employers to make some substantial changes to accommodate those religious workers in our midst. It's the latest, obviously, in a series of rulings, and the Supreme Court has addressed religion during the course of the past terms, including just last term. When we come back, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about those past cases and then come back to this important case having to do with religious accommodations in the workplace, why it's important, and why it's important for all members of the Supreme Court not only to support this, but to understand how this will, in fact, encourage the possibility of religious accommodations in our employment settings. Stay with us for that further discussion about this case and three others here on Morning Cannolis.
And I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me.
This summer, Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK has a new starting lineup. At 10, As Goes Wisconsin. Then at noon, Civic Media Network News. On Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. What does the American public think about recent high-profile Supreme Court decisions? ABC's Chuck Sievertson looks at a recent poll that found 52% approve of the court restricting the use of race in college admissions.
The sample in the new ABC News Ipsos poll is fairly split over the highest court striking down President Biden's student loan debt relief program. It was also pretty evenly split over the court's ruling favoring the evangelical Christian website designer who refused LGBTQ business. 53% say they believe the justices decide cases mainly on the basis of their partisan political views.
Two people were killed, 28 were hurt, three of them in critical condition in a mass shooting at a block party in Baltimore overnight. Police are now searching for suspects. Air travelers have been dealing with delays and cancellations this week, and they could face more today. 50 million people are under severe storm alerts. 60 million are under heat advisories as a heat dome covers 14 states. This is ABC News.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation. When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today. 855-954-1186.
All in to win. Gingras Thompson and Fox. GTWLawyers.com.
This could be the start of a break-in.
Stop. This is Simply Safe.
Or the end of one.
Police are on their way.
Introducing the latest innovation in home security. 24/7 live guard protection. Only from Simply Safe. Now, agents can see and speak to intruders through our new indoor camera to help stop crime in real time and for fast police response. Get 20% off any new system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/radio. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
The law firm of Gingras Thompson & Wachs has a track record of making life-changing, positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson &
Larry, it's your mom. Did you know the Civic Media Network covers the whole state of Wisconsin? They can help your business get the word out, whether you want to reach a smidge of folks or just want the whole kit and caboodle. Call 608-819-8255. Okay then, bye.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
A guy named Bill out in Econowoc. Bill's got some thoughts on that.
Thanks for talking about what you're talking about right now. Your station, you raised the bar high for integrity. You are a community radio station, which means you look out for all the citizens in the state of Wisconsin.
Daily conversations about Wisconsin's latest headlines and stories. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Special broadcast, one of three broadcasts in this time of year talking about recent decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. This morning, focusing on four of those. problem we're talking about right now involves a postal worker. We'll be chatting in this hour and certainly into the next hour about three other cases so that you can write this down, anticipating your phone calls, your comments, your questions. We'll talk about that case in which the Supreme Court also rejected affirmative action programs at Harvard and UNC and presumably other universities and colleges around the nation. Supreme Court also rejected the president's student loan forgiveness plan just this past week. And finally, it backed a web designer who was opposed to same-sex marriage. We'll talk about that case as well and its impact, along with the others, upon our nation. Right now, again, chatting about this case involving a postal worker. The case itself is Groff versus DeJoy. The case itself, again, important because it establishes a new standard embraced by all members of the Supreme Court for addressing the circumstances under which employers are now obliged to accommodate the religious requests, situations, and tenets of faith by employees. Mr. Groff had sued under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. We've talked a lot about that on this broadcast. That's a federal law that requires employers to reasonably accommodate workers' religious practices so long as they can do so without undue hardship to the company's business. That's the language of the statute. And a 1977 precedent called Trans World Airlines versus Hardison, that was the precedent until just this past week, sort of stood in the way of this litigation going forward. That earlier decision said that employers need not accommodate workers, religious workers, including people like Mr. Groff. They did not have to accommodate them if the effort imposed more than a trifling, or in language that lawyers love and other students of Latin love, de minimis, D-E-M-I-N-I-M-I-S, de minimis standard, a low-level burden on their businesses. That was the standard up until just this past week. Lower courts had ruled against Mr. Groff, and the three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Third Circuit in Philadelphia said that accepting Groff from working on Sundays caused more than a de minimis cost to the U.S. Postal Service, because it actually imposed on his co-employees disrupted the workplace and did other things with respect to workflow that, in fact, were more than de minimis. It diminished workplace morale, employee morale, among other co-workers, said the lower court. In a dissent in that case, a judge had said that the majority renders any burden on employees sufficient to establish undue hardship, effectively subjecting Title VII religious accommodation in a heckler's veto by disgruntled employees. A lot to unpack there. The upshot of it is that the Supreme Court, our United States Supreme Court, today embraced that dissenting opinion in the lower court and said, yes, indeed, the standard needs to be higher. The standard now will be focusing upon this higher standard of substantial increased costs that need to be identified as a basis for denying an accommodation. A case that, again, is important not only for Mr. Groff, he identifies himself as an evangelical Christian, but frankly, people of all faiths out there, Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, Islamic, all people of all religions out there who are interested in not only good and decent employment, which all Americans presumably are, but also want to do that in a way that is not inconsistent with their faith, their tenets, and an awful lot of religious organizations and others beyond the faith communities have embraced this particular decision as saying, yes, it updates the standards, ensure that we can, in fact, have good employment. We can be productive in America. Companies can thrive in America by also ensuring that accommodations are made to people of all faiths, and not just those who may purport to ally themselves, for example, with Mr. Groff as evangelical Christians. Across the board, this litigation and the standard that established by the Supreme Court just this past week, inspiring those future claims, those future pieces of litigation. Again, the case does not result in an automatic win for Mr. Groff. The Postal Service has said we can meet that standard as well, that because of the request being made, the Postal Service maintains when this case goes to trial, they will show that they can, in fact, prove that this would have a substantial increased cost upon the operation of this particular postal entity, this venue in particular. We will wait and see. But once again, a major case involving religious accommodation. The Supreme Court, as you know, in recent years has focused a lot on religion, recently ruling that a high school football coach had a constitutional right to pray at the 50-yard line if the team's games, very controversial in terms of religious liberties under the First Amendment. State programs supporting private schools in Maine and Montana must include religious ones as well. That just coming out of last couple of Supreme Court terms. That a Catholic Social Services Agency in Philadelphia could in fact defy some city rules and refuse, decline to work with same-sex couples who apply to take in foster children. And that the Trump administration could allow employers with religious objections to deny contraception coverage to female workers. All kinds of things the Supreme Court has done in this religious area. This case from this past term, just this past week, probably somewhat less controversial. Again, as a sign of that, all nine members of the Supreme Court concur in that. It nonetheless does focus the court's attention once again on its interest in religious cases. We anticipate more of that in the 2022, 2023, 2024 term coming up in the months and the years just ahead. There are three other cases that were also issued to great notoriety this past week, just the past couple of days. Let us now turn our attention to those. Unlike the 9-0 position taken by the Supreme Court in Groff versus DeJoy, these other cases highly split, highly antagonistic among the Supreme Court justices, both in writing and on the bench. We saw some things this past week we have not seen before, which is the articulation of dissents by some of the dissenting members of our court in very bitter and appropriately bitter language about what the Supreme Court is doing in these various areas involving, once again, affirmative action, student loan forgiveness, and yes, LGBT rights and prerogatives in America. Let's take each one of those up in line. We are, again, taking your phone calls, your questions, and your inquiries about these cases as I go through a greater, deeper dive into these next three cases to understand what this is all about and interpreting for you, giving you some perspective of my own about what these cases mean. The overlying, the overreaching theme that I see in each of them is our fundamental difference among members of our Supreme Court in two major areas. One of those major areas is, what is our nation all about? Who are we today? We have got in each one of these cases, especially the cases involving affirmative action and the student loan forgiveness program, certainly the LGBT case as well. We've got a misunderstanding among what I would offer to be the conservative side of the court about what America is all about today and what's going on out there. Those differences very much in evidence in the writings of the Supreme Court, the things they said to us this past week. And second, equally troubling as we go forward with these cases, fundamental disagreements about what our Constitution means in the midst of a nation, the content, the substance, the demeanor of which is not in agreement either. A difference about what the 14th Amendment means. What does equal protection mean? We're going to talk about that. Some fairly virulent dissents condemning the decisions by the majority here in these areas and illustrating once again that the Supreme Court has a schism, if you will, in connection with understanding what the 14th Amendment is all about. Let's talk first about the Affirmative Action Program. This is the second case issued by the Supreme Court just on Thursday of this week. This decision rejected the affirmative action programs at colleges and universities around the nation, declaring this, that race-conscious admissions programs, in particular the defendants so-called in this case Harvard, a private college, and the University of North Carolina, a public institution, were unlawful. They enacted unlawfully, unconstitutionally, and therefore sharply curtailing here a policy that had long been a part of the pillars of higher education. And that policy was and is based upon past Supreme Court precedent, which we'll talk about, that admissions officials, admissions councils, the people who decide on who is coming into an incoming class, could in fact properly consider race as one of many factors, not the exclusive factor, but one of many factors to be considered by an admissions council in determining who gets in and who doesn't. The vote in this case just this past week was 6-3 to turn that policy, that practice back. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, wrote the opinion for the majority. He said this. He said the Harvard and UNC admissions programs cannot be reconciled with the guarantees of the Equal Protection Clause, once again calling into question and raising the ire, if you will, of the three so-called liberals on the bench about the interpretation of that clause. The Chief Justice wanted to say this. Both programs of both of these universities, both colleges, lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race. Objective factors, measurable objectives, insufficiently focused, he said, and therefore unavoidably employing race in a negative manner, involving racial stereotyping and lacking meaningful endpoints. That's kind of at the core of his decision in this case. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, one of the three dissenting justices in this case, we're going to hear more of her words in particular, summarized her dissent from the bench, which again is a rare move, signals profound disagreement, as I've indicated a couple of times already, said that affirmative action was crucial to countering persistent and systemic racial discrimination. That was the reason for the cases being decided as they were in the past. That is the tradition of America for the past 40 years. And that's what all of the universities, both those identified in this litigation and many others who had voiced their concerns about the change in this affirmative action regime, if you will, had articulated, which is that under Brown versus Board of Education, way back in 1954, what did our Supreme Court say? It said that there's something good, there's something very right, something very decent about sitting in a classroom. Sometimes it's also remote, but sitting in a classroom where the people who are surrounding you, your teacher, your professor, but certainly your fellow students, do not look exactly like you, have different experiences, not only in terms of their faith, their racial heritage, their national heritage, their background, their economic status, their sexual orientation, their gender identity, their abilities and disabilities, all those kinds of immutable characteristics that are protected by our Constitution and by statutes in this nation. All those things are promoted. Diversity is a good thing. Promoting education by having a diverse population, that's what the universities had argued in opposition to changing the standard for affirmative action in this nation. Sonia Sotomayor went on to say, the court today subverts the constitutional guarantee of equal protection by further entrenching racial inequality in education. She says it's the very foundation of our democratic government and pluralistic society. Expected, of course, that this sets off a scramble, probably underway for many months, perhaps anticipating this dramatic ruling, among schools, university colleges throughout the nation. Having to revisit their admission practices could complicate diversity efforts elsewhere, probably narrowing, at least for a time, if not indefinitely, the pipeline of highly credentialed minority candidates and making it harder for employers to consider race potentially in hiring as well. In a public televised address just hours after this major decision was handed down, President Biden assailed that ruling as a huge step backwards, very much in line with what the three dissenters said. He said this. He said, discrimination still exists in America. Today's decision does not change that, and promised that this decision was not the last word on affirmative action, an interesting statement for our president to make. Significantly, in her dissent, Justice Sotomayor wrote that the majority had abandoned principled adjudication as well. She wrote this. She said, at bottom, the six unelected members of today's majority, that is the six members who are writing the majority opinion, she said, upend the status quo based on their policy preferences about what race in America should be like. But it is not. And their preferences for a veneer of colorblindness in a society where race has always mattered and continues to matter in fact and in law. That's what Sonia Sotomayor said, again, underscoring this fundamental difference about who we are in America, a difference inside our Supreme Court about the very Constitution with a small c of what our communities of like are and what the diversity of America should be all about. When we come back, I'm going to talk with you more about what the Chief Justice said, what the majority said, what the minority said as well, and but why this case is so very important, not just to our universities, but more broadly to the future of our republic. Stay with us for that discussion.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Continuing in this hour and also the next hour to discuss the United States Supreme Court right now talking about this major decision of just a couple of days ago, finding that affirmative action programs at Harvard and UNC and all other universities and colleges around our nation no longer valid under the Constitution, at least as we have known them. Right before the break, giving you some sense of the strong, strong, profound disagreement among members of our Supreme Court, six of our conservative justices voicing support and endorsing this notion that affirmative action is no longer necessary in the nation in which we live. Three members of the Supreme Court, including Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, taking very, very strong objection to that and talking this morning about the things that both sides have said. Chief Justice John Roberts, again, writing for the majority in support of this invalidation of the affirmative action program, said that applicants must be assessed individually. In other words, he said the student must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race. Now, interestingly, he said this as well. Two footnotes to this otherwise very strident statement about what we need to do in America to ensure diversity, I would offer not just in academic settings, but also beyond that. He said nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. Significant footnote and a significant condition on all this, plainly contemplating that universities can still request that students provide essays, which they certainly will, and in those essays could plainly self-identify based upon, as the Supreme Court said, inspiration and discrimination experiences in those areas. Also indicated along the way later in the opinion, curiously, without a whole lot of exposition, that the military academies might also be able to take account of race in their admissions decisions, as they have, as he said, potentially distinct interests. We don't know exactly what that means, but he's drawing a distinction, obviously, between the military academies that we know well in our nation
and all other universities. So I have to see what that means. But the Supreme Court, again, giving a little bit of hope, if you will, to universities and colleges throughout the country with respect to essays, plainly interviews, those kinds of things, and presumably all the other things that can be done in terms of identifying and trying to establish what the universities universally have wanted in America, which is diverse populations on their campuses as a way of doing what? Promoting education, promoting understanding among the population that is in fact diverse and is not a reflection of just a very narrow view of America. Justice Sonia Sotomayor once again saying that these exceptions, if you will, are fairly thin. She says this supposed recognition that universities can in some situations consider race in application essays is nothing but an attempt, here we go, to put lipstick on a pig. That's what she wrote. That's what she said from the bench this past week. She acknowledged the majority had left colleges and universities with some tools. They're out there to admit students of different backgrounds, mostly notably in socioeconomic factors, again, giving some consideration to financial issues as well. The Chief Justice wrote that educational diversity, he said, that idea that students of different backgrounds learn from one another is a commendable goal. That's good to hear, I suppose, from the Chief Justice. But he also added that such a goal resists the demanding judicial scrutiny that is required when race is a factor because it cannot be measured. That from our Supreme Court Chief Justice. Again, in dissent, Sonia Sotomayor writes that effectively the majority has jettisoned the rationale that had justified affirmative action for decades. And indeed, that is, in fact, the case. 200 pages of majority opinions and minority opinions here. Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett join the Chief Justice's majority opinion. And, of course, Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson joined Justice Sotomayor in her strong dissent in all of this. Significant that only from the bench when this was argued way back in the fall of last year, but a strong disagreement between a fellow named Clarence Thomas and Ketanji Brown Jackson from the bench. Clarence Thomas writes a 58-page concurring opinion and drawing on his own experience as a black man. He mounted what he called a defense of the colorblind Constitution. In order to clarify, he said that all forms of discrimination based on race, including so-called affirmative action, are prohibited under the Constitution. His remarks, both again from the bench way back in the fall and again written and announced just this past week, get a strong sense of resistance from the minority members of our Supreme Court, inside and outside. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, along with Thomas, one of only three black justices who ever served on the court, responded again bitterly to what she is hearing from her conservative colleagues. She says this, with let them eat cake obliviousness today, the majority pulls the ripcord and announces colorblindness for all by legal fiat. But deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life. She argued that for many Americans, race permeates their lived experience daily. The best that can be said of the majority's perspective, she went on to say, is that it proceeds ostrich-like, that is, putting your head in the sand, from the hope that preventing consideration of race will end racism. The approach embraced by the court in Chief Justice John Roberts' majority opinion on Thursday has been a long-term goal, plainly, of the conservative legal activists. This has been out there for a long period of time, not entirely unexpected, not only in the wake of the oral argument of last fall, but also for many, many years previous to this. We know as well, again, as I said, that this is a significant change in the law that's been announced and has been effective for about 40 years. The two cases from UNC and Harvard derive from Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and also equal protection of the 14th Amendment. The North Carolina case, plaintiffs have said that the university discriminated against white and Asian applicants by giving preference to black, Hispanic, and Native American ones. The university, again, has responded by saying that its admissions policies fostered exactly the kind of educational diversity that I'm describing this morning and were lawful under long-standing positions of the United States Supreme Court. That key precedent, way back in 2003, announced by Sandra Day O'Connor, one of the conservative justices, case was called Grutter versus Bollinger, in which the Supreme Court said that holistic admissions programs permitting race to be considered for the purposes of educational diversity are appropriate and endorsed and constitutional. That was Sandra Day O'Connor and a majority of our Supreme Court in 2003, not that long ago. Significantly, Sandra Day O'Connor said that it may well come that in a day, maybe about 25 years from now, or in 2028, she said the use of racial preference will no longer be necessary. Well, the Supreme Court advanced that a few years. Justice John Roberts said there's no reason to believe that respondents will, even acting in good faith, comply anytime soon. That day has come. And it came in America just this past week. Stay with us for this second hour of Morning Cannolis. We're going to talk more about this admissions case and then also about the other two major cases of this past week, this past term, right here on our morning discussion of America and the law by which we are governed.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
So much waiting for me. Yeah, I wanna go outside. I wanna be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK 1260 AM Amory, and always streaming on the Civic